I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, can peace on the Korean Peninsula ever be achieved? And what is the new president, Joe Biden's, approach to foreign policy in the Far East? Joining us to answer those questions is Tim Schrock, an investigative journalist of high repute at The Nation. For years, Tim has been writing about U.S.-Korea relations and is one of the most astute reporters on the subject. He joins us on this edition of Parallax Views to discuss his latest article in The Nation entitled Biden is Adopting a Militaristic Approach to the Far East. In addition to this article, we also discuss the defense industry and its role in formulating DC foreign policy, the history of U.S.-Korea relations, the hawkish new National Security Council appointee, Kurt Campbell, the Center for a New American Security Think Tank, and much, much more. And now on to the conversation with Tim Schrock. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I've wanted to have on for a long time now. We're finally doing it. Tim Schrock, American journalist covering U.S. foreign policy, U.S. national security and intelligence, and East Asian politics. How are you doing, Tim?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So, Tim, you have a new article out in The Nation magazine entitled Biden is Adopting a Militaristic Approach to the Far East. Before we get into that article, could you give a little bit of background on how you became involved in covering politics, geopolitics in the Far East, U.S. relations with countries like North Korea and South Korea and Japan, etc.? Could you tell my listeners a little bit about your background?
Well, I grew up in Japan and South Korea, for starters. And I actually went to Japan when I was like 1 year old, 1 year old, and lived there for, you know, on and off until I was 18. And in the middle period, I lived in South Korea. My father was working for a large church relief organization that did post-war relief work in Asia after World War II. So, you know, I grew up in Asia during the Cold War, and in Korea and Japan, there was large, you know, there was movements for democracy. And in Japan, really big anti-war movement, and I became very aware of, you know, the politics of what was going on in Vietnam when I was a youth, and, you know, had to confront the issue of what would I do if I got drafted, and, you know, I didn't want to go to Vietnam. So my father actually taught a course in a university on the history of Vietnam. So I learned a lot about Vietnam, and that, and during the war, I was very active in the anti-war movement. And during the anti-war movement and afterwards, I, you know, a lot of people that were involved started looking at the corporations, you know, behind the war, you know, like Dow Chemical that supplied napalm and you know, companies that made the bombs. And, you know, I got really interested in like following, you know, the corporate side of foreign policy. And And that led me, but also, you know, knowing what happened in, when I was a youth in Korea, especially when I actually was a witness to a popular revolution that toppled a longtime dictator, that really awakened me to some truths about South Korea and North Korea. And after I went to graduate school in Asian studies, I began to write a lot about Korea. So I've basically been writing about Korea and Japan as a journalist since the late 1970s.
If I could, a second part of that question I should ask, and I always ask this because I feel like sometimes in America, we've talked less and less with regards to the general public about foreign policy. For people that may think, well, how does that affect me, our relations with South Korea or North Korea or Japan? What would you say to people that don't think about foreign policy that much? Why should we really start paying attention more to these issues?
Well, for one thing, we have 100,000 American soldiers in Japan and Korea. There you go. And they've been there since 1945. Why are they still there? Why is there such a massive U.S. military, infrastructure in East Asia? I mean, it was originally built because we had to, contain the Soviet Union and contain communism, right? Well, the Soviet Union collapsed, years ago, decades ago. Until recently, there's been decent relations with China since, Nixon made that breakthrough with Chairman Mao back in the early 70s. So what are they there for? The U.S. always changes its rationale for having troops there. And lots of Americans, so all you have to do is ask two or three people and you'll find someone who served in Japan, served in Okinawa, served in South Korea. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Americans have served there over the last, six, seven decades. So that's one reason that people should be concerned about it. But, it's also an area where nuclear war is always a possibility. And if we're concerned about nuclear proliferation and the role of the United States in that, well, Japan and Korea, especially Korea, are places to start.
Now, with regards to this article in The Nation, you're really dealing with the approach Biden seems to be taking with the Far East. You point out in the title of the article, he's adopting maybe a militaristic approach to the Far East. Could you comment on what you're seeing from Biden so far? I mean, we've seen, I guess, positive signs when it comes to maybe backing off of supporting the Saudi just atrocities in Yemen. But in other ways, he's being a bit more hawkish in his administration.
I've actually been following, Biden's policies on Korea for The Nation for a while and have been sort of, looking from the people that were close to him and sort of predicting and, reporting what they say about Korea as a way to point towards what his policy might be. And so basically, so far his national security team is, led by Secretary of State Tony Blinken and his Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, both of them served at high level positions in the Obama administration, which took a very hawkish and very kind of, in many ways, foolish approach toward North Korea, which was basically to wish they would go away and refused to negotiate with them because the wish was they would eventually, collapse and we wouldn't have to worry about it, which was a, huge blunder. And, like when Trump used to say, when he took over, Korea was the most dangerous place in the world, according to Obama, it was correct. And, we were almost at war with North Korea because of the refusal of the United States to make any kind of attempt to defuse the situation. We've had nuclear weapons there, for decades. They're no longer in South Korea, but North Korea has been under nuclear threat itself since the Korean War. So, that's an important place to start. But, to get, in a little more detail about, Biden's team, South Korea, South and North Korea are one country, right? They've been divided you know, since 19, officially they've been divided since 1948, but the U.S. drew the division in 1945 unilaterally, and the Soviets went along. It was the end of the World War II kind of, you know, conclusion, and they were figuring out what to do in terms of accepting Japan's surrender. And so that, you know, Korea was a colony of Japan from 1910 to 1945, ruled brutally by the Japanese. And in 1945, the U.S., when the U.S. Took responsibility for Southern Korea, they, you know, both the U.S. and Soviet Union decided that Korea itself was not yet ready for self-rule. And therefore, they had to be sort of run by outside powers until it was. And the U.S. occupied the South, the Soviet Union occupied the North. There was a difference in how they occupied it, though. The U.S. from the first day declared South Korea a U.S.-run military government. In other words, the U.S. Army ran South Korea. The Soviet Union picked people to run the country that had been fighting the Japanese for decades in the mountains of, you know, in Manchuria and in Korea itself. But they ruled through the North Korean structure, ruled directly through its own military government. And, you know, Cold War politics came into play really early. The U.S. saw any people that supported unification and did not want to be divided, as they basically saw any opposition to their own military government and the South Koreans they appointed to run their military government as communist inspired. And the real key to understanding our history in Korea is to look at those years before the Korean War, when there was actually a very, you know, massive leftist led opposition in South Korea that became an insurgency, that became an armed insurgency. And there was uprisings in different parts of South Korea that were mercilessly crushed by the U.S. managed army and police. I mean, mercilessly, tens of thousands of people slaughtered and murdered, civilians. I mean, it's if anyone, you know, has read the book, The Jakarta Method, in many ways, South Korea was the beginning of the Jakarta Method. Anything communist or we think is communist is dead, basically. And, you know, that's something that's just unknown about. And that's where the roots of the Korean War are. And, you know, it's true that Kim Il-sung and North Korea army invaded South Korea in 1950. But it came after it was clear that the left in South Korea had been crushed, and a very popular left, I might add. You know, I mean, a lot, this wasn't just some kind of like fringe communist party. I mean, a lot of people, you know, common regular people, workers, peasants, you know, people supported liberation, full liberation, and, you know, wanted Korea to be its own country, not controlled by outside powers. And by 1950, basically, after this counterinsurgency in the South had been subdued, it was after that that North Korea began to really plan to, in their view, liberate South Korea from the U.S. And they got assistance and the green light from Stalin in the Soviet Union and Chairman Mao in China. And as you know, the Chinese troops intervened massively in 1950 after the U.S.-led U.N. forces crossed the border into North Korea, occupied North Korea, and the top general MacArthur was talking publicly, openly about nuking Chinese cities. You know, and the Chinese moved their forces in and basically pushed the U.S.-led U.N. forces back to really where they were originally. So that war from 51 to 53 was just a terrible, terrible war. And the U.S. completely destroyed North Korea in its bombings, which is about the most devastating bombing campaign in world history.
If I could, in that regard, first off, I want to say I actually had Vincent Bevins on a few months ago to talk about the Jakarta Method. That's a very important book. And I think what you're talking about really gives us the other side of the story. I think a lot of people
just look at North Korea and say, oh, they must be an enemy of the U.S. They're just the enemy of the U.S. And they don't look at how there is this long history between the U.S. and these Asian countries where sometimes, you know, these countries in opposition to the U.S. have a lot of reasons to be distrustful or angry with us over past indiscretions.
Well, in the case of North Korea, the bombing I just mentioned was just devastating. I mean, you know, something like 3 million civilians were killed in North Korea. They never forget it, you know. I mean, and like, you know, whenever American reporters, you know, manage to get into North Korea and they go to the war museum, they write these articles about how all the propaganda they hear, and you know, but it's like, it's true. This, people remember this, and it was, you know, for a tiny small country, it was, for any country, it was just devastating. And the same is true in South Korea. The U.S. bombed indiscriminately in South Korea. It didn't bomb the cities, but it bombed hamlets and villages and you know, strafed, you know, people. And there's lots of stories of South Korean civilians being massacred in this huge overplay of firepower that was the Korean War. So, yeah, North Korea had, you know, like, North Korea now is a, you know, no one can question the fact that it's a highly authoritarian state that, you know, persecutes and prosecutes any citizens who step out of line and criticize, you know, government or dissidents are mercilessly crushed. And they have, you know, large system of prison camps. So the percentage of people in prison in North Korea is far less than the United States. But, you know, it is a authoritarian place, and it has a history of, you know, leaders purging his competitors, or in many cases executing them. And, you know, it's run in a very, well, undemocratic is, you know, hardly giving justice to the word, but you know, it's a draconian kind of system, you know. Okay, but is, you know, the question is, what's its relation? We intervened in Korea to prevent North Korea from, you know, to supposedly stop this Korean War, or you know, stop the North Korean invasion and quash it, you know. But we've been there ever since. You know, we have 28,500 troops there now, and you know, the rationale for, you know, the U.S. protecting South Korea by military forces is long outdated. I mean, South Korea has a military itself that may be seven times as large as North Korea. And they don't have nuclear weapons, but they have all kinds of, you know, so-called conventional weapons that are far more advanced than anything North Korea has. And they're also part of an alliance with the United States and a kind of quasi-alliance with Japan, where the U.S. has all its forces in Japan. And so it's got North Korea has a lot of military might arrayed against it. And it has legitimate, you know, interests in its national survival. And so, you know, even the most conservative, you know, these North Korea, many, many North Korea experts out there now, even by them, you know, North Korea developed nuclear weapons because it wanted to survive. It wanted the regime to survive. And they saw that, especially after the, you know, Bush's invasion of Iraq, you know, in 2003, and then later on, a U.S. and NATO-led toppling of Gaddafi in Libya after Gaddafi had gotten rid of his nuclear program. North Korea, you know, really stepped up its plans, you know, after that. But the thing is, the United States first deployed nuclear weapons in Korea in 1958. And this was in violation of the armistice that temporarily ended the war. And they introduced hundreds and hundreds of nuclear weapons. So some ground soldiers of the U.S. often had, you know, these small nuclear weapons you can carry on your shoulder, right? They had these for decades. And George H.W. Bush, when he was president in 1991, removed U.S. tactical nuclear weapons from South Korea and other countries where they had these similar kinds of weapons. North Korea did not explode its first nuclear weapon until 2006 under George W. Bush. So when people wonder, like, well, shouldn't it be an enemy? Well, why is it an enemy? Who does it really threaten? And, you know, a country trying to survive is not necessarily a threat to us offensively. And so, you know, the Biden administration, to get back to that, is trying to make this like, you know, a regional problem and, you know, bring in our allies like Japan and India and so on, in Australia to make it part of that. But, you know, North Korea, its beef is with the U.S. and for good reason. You know, it's not the North Korea versus all of Asia. It's North Korea versus the U.S. That's the contradiction. That's the point of stress. That's the point of tension. And that's what needs to be resolved. And what South Korea desperately wants the U.S. to help resolve. So, you know, look at it broadly. That's what I encourage anyone to do.
No, I would definitely agree with that. And I think in looking at it more broadly, one thing that you bring up in this article is the Asia pivot that happened under Obama.
Right.
What was the Asia pivot? And maybe what's the broad picture of that?
Well, the idea was, you know, okay, you know, the locus of the global economy and the locus of, you know, so much of the U.S. future, economic and political future, is in Asia. So, you know, and the wars in Iraq were disastrous. And so let's shift the focus of the U.S. military away from the Middle East and back to Asia, where there's always been this massive buildup. And that was sort of the idea of it. And the idea was to also be prepared to confront and contain China, because it was in the, you know, rising as a military and economic power in the region. So it was seen as like, you know, sort of a reordering of U.S. military forward basing after, you know, the Iraq war and all that came after that, the war in Afghanistan. And they, you know, they did start this shift. And actually, you know, by numbers, it's not that large. The numbers of troops in South Korea, of U.S. troops in South Korea and in Japan, has not really changed appreciably during that time. But the U.S. has developed much closer military ties, deeper ties with Australia, and also Japan. And like, they have this, you know, in this earlier article, I had talked about the Indo-Pacific term that they keep using, Biden's people keep using for the Asia Pacific, because it includes India now. And there's this four-way alliance the U.S. has now, basically to contain China, which is the U.S., Australia, Japan, and India. And the U.S. is putting all kinds of pressure on South Korea to join that kind of a formal alliance.
And North Korea is seen as being an ally to China. So they get sucked into this. Okay.
Right. And yeah, so like the focus of the U.S. policy is mostly China, but you know, everyone knows, you know, China and North Korea have been, you know, close as lips and teeth, as the Chinese used to say. But China is a close North Korean ally, but it does not have troops in North Korea. It has not had troops since, like, I think sometime in the 1950s, they withdrew them all. Of course, Russia, Soviet Union, has not had troops there since the Korean War. They never had troops there except for the occupation. But during the Korean War, the Soviet military was involved. They flew MiGs and stuff like that. So yeah, but you do have this close relationship between China and North Korea. So, you know, the U.S. sees, you know, this Quad, as they call it, alliance allied against China and North Korea jointly. And so they want South Korea to be part of it. But, you know, South Korea has its own interests in not, you know, having this confrontational, you know, position with China. And they actually have, you know, pretty close relations with China, and especially economic. And they also, you know, South Korea's view of North Korea is very different than the U.S. because it's, you know, it's part of a process that the Koreas have been at since really the 70s to try to reconcile and have, you know, eventually move towards some kind of, you know, unification. And, you know, so like South Korea by its own choice, is very constrained in what it can do with North Korea by its alliance with the U.S. And that's actually a real source of great tension in South Korea and U.S. relations right now, that you only can find out by reading the tea leaves of, like, you know, or reading the Korean press, or, you know, following various people with expertise in the region. But it's not very well known, but, you know, the tensions are pretty high. If there's going to be a crisis in Korea soon, which I think there's going to be, it's going to be with both North and South Korea. North Korea sort of militarily, and South Korea, you know, politically.
Now, one of the figures you point to in this article that we should maybe keep an eye on and maybe talk about a little bit in this conversation is Kurt Campbell. Who is Kurt Campbell, and why is he so relevant?
Well, we just talked about the Asia pivot under Obama. He is seen as sort of the architect of that. You know, like Hillary Clinton really promoted him when she was Secretary of State, but he's the guy that, you know, put together all the ideological position papers and argued for it, you know, publicly. And so that's one thing. And he, you know, during Obama, he was the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and the Pacific. So, you know, he played a major role in its, what I consider its very hardline militarist approach toward North Korea, which was actually to the right of even George W. Bush. There was a much less emphasis on negotiation than under Bush. And so he's, you know, he was part of that. But, you know, I probably should have brought it out sharper. And this is more like grounds for an op-ed. But, like, if you read, you know, U.S. diplomatic statements these days that are coming out of, you know, Blinken's State Department, you can really see how they, you know, the U.S. is very demanding of its allies. You know, the U.S., you know, the whole thing about Biden when he was running against Trump was, you know, Trump disturbed alliances and, you know, made, you know, was making all these demands of they pay more and so on and so forth. You know, well, Biden's, you know, may not do what Trump did in terms of forced them to pay more, but he's certainly demanding of what he wants out of them. And, like, for example, you know, there's been, you know, historically, there's been long history of disputes between Korea and Japan over Japan's role in World War II, right? It's slaves, sexual slavery, and industrial workers that are forced to go to Japan. And these disputes are real. And there is an ongoing, you know, legal dispute between South Korean courts and Japanese corporations about that. And Japan has made it a point of, you know, like, really, you know, splitting with Korea on that issue. And Biden, of course, and his people, like, just like Trump did, are, like, telling Korea to, you know, cool it, you know, stop bringing up these historical issues so much, and, like, get your shit together with Japan, kind of thing, you know, get it together, you know, be good allies and stop bickering among yourselves, basically treating them like children. And, you know, Campbell was, you know, a key part of that. You know, during the Obama administration, the stress on getting South Korea to link with Japan, that's where the pressure really came on with the U.S. And as I write in this story, it's really important. Okay, third of all, Campbell has been selected as the guy in charge of Asia policy at the White House, at the National Security Council. So he's running this sort of Asia, whatever they call it, group within the NSC. And so it's all part of the, you know, anti-China policies that are coming up. But he is the key person getting all the other agencies on the same page of Biden's Asia policy. So he's, you know, back in a very important role. But the final thing is their role, you know, like I've said, like, they really are trying to cajole South Korea into having this, you know, formal alliance with Japan. Which is not a popular idea in Korea at all. And the role of people like Campbell is to keep the, you know, allies in line, right? And so there's a story I relate in this, which I researched this story a bunch of years ago. I reported it in The Nation. But, you know, WikiLeaks got all these, during the election of 2016, they got all these leaks from Hillary Clinton's State Department, right?
Right. Are these diplomatic cables?
Yeah, the diplomatic cables, and those were you know, anyway, WikiLeaks and Verso published a book. They hired a bunch of writers like me to focus on the cables in certain areas of the world, right? And I wrote about Korea and Japan, what we learned. And one of the things I found out, and I've actually talked to the Japanese former prime minister who was the subject of this pressure, was in 2009, Japan was led by its first kind of progressive prime minister for decades, right? This opposition party had kicked out the old right-wing ruling party. And he ran on a platform to, you know, get the U.S. Marines out of Okinawa. But also he wanted to, this prime minister, Aoyama, wanted to sort of rewrite and expose the rules that the U.S. had operated under militarily in Japan that in his view, violated Japanese sovereignty and had been hidden from the Japanese people. And one of these was an agreement that went way back. You know, Japan suffered nuclear weapons, right? It's the only country to ever have nuclear weapons launched at it. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were destroyed. So it's always had this like anti-nuclear, you know, part of its policies in terms of its own, you know, within Japan, like it's, you know, anti-nuclear principles. And for years, the U.S. Sailed, you know, its ships would go in and out of Japan loaded with nuclear weapons, right? And you know, the ruling party just let that go by. So this prime minister wanted to expose those agreements and make them public and try to have, you know, a new kind of relationship with the U.S. where the U.S. didn't have all this kind of unilateral power. And so this was not acceptable to President Obama and Hillary Clinton at the State Department. And so they sent, among others, they sent Kurt Campbell on a mission to like dissuade this prime minister from doing this. And they managed to humiliate him by forcing a really screwed up agreement on Okinawa where the U.S. Marines were, they didn't have to leave this one base that they're a big source of tension about. And Japan agreed to build a new Marine base in another part of the island. And that was humiliating because this prime minister had vowed to get the Marines out. And then the second thing was they pushed hard against this changing of the U.S.-Japan alliance and they forced him out of office, basically. He resigned. And then about a year later, his party lost power. And again, the ruling Liberal Democratic Party came in. Super right-wingers that were created with the help of millions of dollars from the CIA in the 50s. And they've been in power ever since. You know, that ruling party is one of the most obsequiously pro-American parties on earth. And they'll basically do whatever the U.S. says. You know, that's the situation. So that's, you know, Campbell was involved in all of that. And I see no possibility of, you know, his changing his basic framework. It's going to be, we want you to do, you know, we want to maintain this huge military posture in Asia, and we want you to go along with it. That's going to be his role.
So it's interesting to me, you know, there's these, as you point out in the article, there's these hardliners and then there's the pro-engagement forces
right
within the Democratic Party that are sort of in a tug of war over how to deal with these foreign policy issues. There's also this concept that you mentioned very briefly of the DC blob, the Washington blob, and I think the Center for a New American Security, which Campbell was involved with. What is the Center for a New American Security, and what does it have to do with this idea of the DC blob, that there's this sort of foreign policy consensus that absorbs everything in DC?
Well, remember, in 1961, President Eisenhower warned against the pernicious influence of the military-industrial complex, right? You know, back then, the military-industrial complex was obviously, you know, powerful and a danger, but it had the amount of power it had nothing compared to today, right? I mean, you have these think tanks, so-called, that are funded heavily by the defense industry and the military industry, such as the Center for New America Security and the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And so they have huge amounts of money, and not just from defense contracts. They get money from governments like Japan, friendly to the U.S. They get a lot of money from the U.S. government itself. And then they promote very hardline policies, hawkish policies. CNAS, Center for New American Security, started out, and Kirk Campbell was his co-founder, right? Back in 2007 with Michelle Flournoy, another former Pentagon official in the Obama administration who Biden considered for a while for Secretary of Defense, but I think her ties to this so-called blog were too much, so he refrained, but obviously Campbell got in. But they started it as sort of this was during the Iraq War, at the tail end of the Iraq War in Afghanistan. And they were against the invasion of Iraq, but they still wanted the Democratic Party to be seen as hawkish and realistic and pragmatic when it came to military issues. And so that was the whole idea behind CNAS and its formation in 2007 and 2008. At the beginning, they were really a big advocate of the counterinsurgency war in Afghanistan, which was Obama's first choice, to do this kind of hearts and minds campaign where you win over the population, not only by military force, but by civilian projects, AID, et cetera, et cetera. And they tried that for a while. And interestingly, at the time when Biden was vice president, he was against that counterinsurgency strategy. So CNAS was a huge promoter of General Petraeus and all the ideologues behind this coin strategy. But then they soon turned their attention to the Pacific, and they were a big force behind promoting the idea of the Asia pivot, the Pacific pivot, and they've really become sort of the most pronounced think tank in terms of confronting China. And the thing is, these think tanks have incredible amount of influence. And, they really frame all the, when you read the newspapers, at least mainstream papers, New York Times, Washington Post, they completely rely on these think tanks for their analysis. If you read, especially in Korea, I was in Singapore when Trump met Kim Jong-un. And, to me, this was a real historical event. And, I saw it as actually a real step forward, as did most South Koreans. It was an important move, and it did really change the fundamental situation there on the ground for a while. And then I started reading the coverage of the same meetings, the same events I was covering, and I'd read in the Post, and they would always have, about second or third paragraph down, there'd be like, according to experts, blah, blah, blah. And who would be the first guy quoted would be Victor Cha of the Center for Strategic International Studies, or someone at CNAS, but at the beginning it was always CSIS. And so people read the Washington Post and they think, oh, this must be it's the truth. It's the media. Right. And these experts must know what they're saying, but their ties to the military industry and the military industrial complex are never, made clear to readers. So instead of saying, the think tank CSIS said this, you should say, the think tank CSIS, which is backed by many of the companies, backed by many military contractors and companies that benefit from a war in Korea or, the warlike atmosphere in Korea, say this. So you can understand where they're coming from or why they might be hawkish, but that's the blob. It's like not, I think most American citizens aren't aware the way the newspapers and media reports it, and of course the same people that are quoted in the Times and the Post, within 5 minutes of their story being posted, they'll be on CNN, right? So everyone gets access to their wonderful insight, but it's unclear and never made clear, what those insights come from. Who funds those insights?
And with regards to the Center for a New American Security, you note that They've been funded by many military contractors. A few of them are General Atomics, Boeing, General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon. That's like a who's who of the defense industry.
And you know, it's also who's who of the companies that benefit most from the U.S. military posture in Northeast Asia. General Atomics makes these huge, you know, drones that actually South Korea just bought like four of them or something, you know, like the biggest drones, the Global Hawk, that's what it's called, right? They're the biggest drones that are made by the U.S. And, you know, Raytheon makes missiles and, you know, Lockheed Martin supplies the missile defense ships, the Aegis ships, you know, these destroyers that are armed with small missiles that can shoot down larger missiles. So, supposedly, like Japan and South Korea both have Aegis ships in their fleet, right? And they're all integrated with the U.S. Navy, of course. So, yeah, those kind of companies benefit like crazy. So, like Victor Cha, funded by, you know, Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, you know, says we have to have a stronger military posture against North Korea. Well, you know, maybe that would explain things a little bit more. But these connections are—that's the problem—is that they're hidden.
Now, in talking about these issues, I think that a lot of younger people, you know, they go to higher education, or they read the New York Times, or they read the Post, and they say, "Well, we have to have these pressure campaigns against North Korea. We have to, you know, make provocations towards China. These are draconian states." And even you yourself have said, you know, North Korea can be considered very authoritarian. So is there another way to deal with these countries other than aggression and provocation? Because I think that's the mindset that a lot of people, especially my age, have sort of been given since the war on terror. I mean, North Korea was called what? Part of the Axis of Evil. So I think we almost grew up with this mindset. What would you say to people that maybe have adopted that mindset without thinking through it?
Well, I would say this. In terms of North Korea, we've had sanctions against North Korea since 1948, and certainly even more since 1953. So, you know, a hell of a lot of good that's done in terms of curbing any kind of their, you know, their military program, right? And, you know, especially since the 1990s, when they decided, they sort of sparked the first nuclear crisis with the U.S. under the Clinton administration, when they pulled out of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty and, you know, started proceeding, you know, building elements of the nuclear program. I mean, the sanctions have been piled high since then. And it's probably the most sanctioned country in the world. And look, they're building weapons at the, you know, the U.S. intelligence agencies and the U.S. military keep seeing are, you know, getting more and more powerful, right? And these think tanks, all these, you know, CNS, and they're, oh, look, North Korea's been building its nuclear weapons and so on and so forth. So why do you want to tighten sanctions? I mean, what are sanctions going to do there? You know, in terms of Korea, one of the important things about North Korea is to read what, this is true for any country, of course, but, you know, to read what they say about it, right? And, you know, for years, you know, North Korea has said they will end their nuclear program or they will disarm to an extent. But the U.S. must change and stop its hostile, what they call its hostile policy. And this is always kind of written off as nothing by, you know, specialists and, you know, they laugh it off. Hostile policy is just propaganda, blah, blah, blah. It's not. I did some reporting on this, you know, to find out from South Koreans who had dealt with North Korea a lot, and what they mean by hostile policy. You know, they mean they want to have a normal relationship with the United States. And they've been saying this for years. They've been saying they want a peace treaty to end the Korean War for years. So I think dialogue and engagement has shown to be far more effective than sanctions. And I'll give the example of President Clinton. You know, when there was this nuclear crisis I mentioned, they almost went to war with North Korea in 1994. It came very close. They were, according to his former Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, he had gone to Japan and South Korea and was planning the logistics of the war, you know, going to the bases and figuring out how you know, the attack would be launched. And they were ready to go. And at that moment, Jimmy Carter jumped into the picture and went to North Korea, met with Kim Il-sung, the founder and at the time president of North Korea. And they hammered out a deal that became the Clinton deal, which was, at the time, they didn't have weapons. They were building a complex for weapons, but they did not have nuclear weapons. And so they agreed to stop their program and not process plutonium, which is the key ingredient in nuclear weapons. And then in return, the U.S. agreed to help create a consortium that, so they needed electrical power, right? Besides nuclear, they had a nuclear reactor. So the U.S. agreed with Japan and South Korea to build a light water reactor that's much harder to make weapons out of. And they began supplying fuel oil to North Korea. And this agreement, North Korea's moratorium on producing weapons grade plutonium lasted for a full 12 years. They did not do that. And that agreement was enforced for quite a long time. Unfortunately, this was 94 when the agreement was created, right? That November is when Newt Gingrich took over the Republicans in the House. And the House went Republican for the first time in, 40 years, right? And the first thing, foreign policy thing they attacked Clinton for was appeasement of North Korea. They began attacking and undermining this agreement. And so there was a lot of tension. But then at the end of the Clinton administration, under Bill Perry, North Korea had agreed to deepen this agreement. Like, they wanted to really move toward normalization with the U.S., normal relations. And so with the agreement still in force, not making weapons grade material, and they had negotiations for months. And they were very close when Bush took over in 2001. The Clinton administration was like this close to an agreement with North Korea where they were going to give up their entire missile production program. They would have ended their missile program in return for normalization and on another diplomatic and economic normalization. And Clinton, because of the election of that year, couldn't make it to North Korea to finalize the agreement. And Bush took over. And, like Biden is doing now, Bush wanted to reverse all these, Clinton era policies. And like he immediately said, when the South Korean president was here, Kim Dae-jung, who was the famous opposition leader in South Korea, who had really been the first one. He'd had the first summit ever between South and North Korea a few years earlier. Bush bluntly said, "We're not going to negotiate. We don't trust North Korea. We're not going to negotiate." He just ended this negotiation. And then a couple of years into Bush, not long after he declared them part of the Axis of Evil, not long after that, they threw out the Clinton agreement because they claimed that North Korea had built a uranium program to make nuclear bombs through uranium. And actually, at the time, it wasn't true. At the time, North Korea was buying equipment that might be used for uranium. And that's what U.S. intelligence had picked up in all these invoices or whatever they can track. And then said, okay, North Korea is building a uranium facility. They violated the agreement. Bush sent a low-level diplomat there who said, we just told them the agreement's over. And North Korea said, well, we believe we have a right to build this under the agreement, but we're happy to negotiate with you about it. And they refused to push it anymore, and they just threw out the agreement. And from that point on, then North Korea said, okay, inspectors were kicked out, and they reopened their plutonium facility. And by this was what, this was like 2002, 2003. And by 2006, they had exploded their first bomb. So, confrontation doesn't work.
I guess I was going to add to that. When I look at the Bush presidency, which I grew up during the Bush presidency, right, that's when I started becoming very politicized. I just saw everything that was going on, all the hawkishness, all the warmongering, and it seems to have just led to quagmires and more problems. And yet there's still this debate over, well, we need to be more hawkish on China. And, you know, people don't seem to look at diplomacy as a solution enough. Do you think there's any hope for a more diplomatic approach, or has the Bush era sort of captured us in this, like, you know, total war mindset?
It's hard to say. The Bush era mindset was also fueled by 9/11, right? And what happened, you know, the Al-Qaeda attacks on New York and Washington and the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. So it was all, you know, fueled by that, as was, you know, this massive, you know, increase in our intelligence budgets in, you know, 2002, 2003, and, you know, vast expansion of military budgets as well. And then the war in Iraq, and then the war in Afghanistan, you know, so it was all kind of under that sort of anti, you know, terrorism kind of ideology. And, you know, towards the end of the Trump administration, the Pentagon and all these, you know, great national strategy thinkers we supposedly have in Washington, then began to say, you know, we have to now shift back to, you know, like, you know, state-to-state confrontation as opposed to this kind of, you know, global counterinsurgency, right? We have to, it's power structures that matter, like big countries, big powers like Russia and China. And like, we have to reorient our military around that. That's probably what the Pacific pivot was about. So, I mean, Bush carried militarism to an extreme by invading Iraq. It's probably, you know, one of the greatest, worst decisions ever made by any president ever. And, you know, just look what he sowed in the Middle East and Iraq in particular. But I think militarism never faded. And, you know, part of the formation that we talked about earlier about, you know, Center for New American Security is, you know, they wanted to, you know, still be tough, but, you know, do it smarter, right? You know, don't be stupid like Bush, be smart like, you know, Obama or Biden, right? And, you know, only use national, you know, the full force of the U.S. military when it's absolutely necessary, or, you know, other kinds of thinking. But the basic idea that we still need to have, you know, 800 military bases around the world and this massive number of bases in East Asia, Japan and Korea never went away. In fact, you know, that base strategy is enhanced by the Democrats. And I think that this is something, you know, Americans really need to consider when we look at East Asia. I mean, like, you have Okinawa, which is a chain of islands south of Japan that takes up less than 1% of the Japan landmass, is the home to 70% of U.S. military bases in Japan. It's an enormous, terrible burden. The people of Okinawa have suffered greatly under the U.S. military, and it continues. And, you know, I mean, Biden and his Democrats in Congress, they could care less about the people of Okinawa and the struggle they've had against the U.S. bases and against the Japanese government allied with the U.S. that allows the situation to continue. And so, you know, I think only the form of militarism has changed. You know, you don't have the same ideological push like you had with Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and all those neocons that came along in that early part of that administration. But you still have, you know, these people and all these people, you know, Biden disappointed. A lot of them are like neocons. They'll intervene, and, you know, when they think it's in American interest, and they'll be willing to, you know, do anything to preserve American power. That's still a real danger. I mean, I knew I would be in this position with Biden. I mean, of course, I support, you know, better policies on labor and, you know, supporting trade unions and teachers unions and having a better approach toward the pandemic and, you know, using public resources to help the people. I'm all for that. But on foreign policy, Biden's promises of reconciliation about America do not apply to the world. And, you know, it's America first. It's that I don't see a big change from that. And I think I find that, you know, I find that very troubling. And I find that that's why it's important to really look at, you know, different parts of the world where there is this kind of tension and really try to understand the U.S. role.
Now, we've gone about an hour here. I just had two things, if you could briefly. You mentioned that there are some officials being appointed by Biden who are skilled in diplomacy, like Wendy Sherman, who are, you know, potentially maybe the opposite of Campbell. Would you agree with that? Do you think there's hope in that regard?
Well, I didn't mention that in my article, you know, like Sherman herself was part of that policy team that almost reached the missile agreement with North Korea in 2000. You know, she was working for Albright, who was the Secretary of State then. And so, you know, she understands, you know, what engagement and what diplomacy can achieve with North Korea and, you know, what it can't achieve. I think she has a pretty pragmatic view on it. But, you know, she's going to be the Deputy Secretary of State. And as I pointed out in the article also, there's a guy who's appointed Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Asia, who earlier had been U.S. Ambassador to South Korea and the Philippines, and he helped a lot with Trump's negotiations with Kim Jong-un in the past few years. And like, so he might be, he understands diplomacy and how it works with North Korea. But I think it's the people that really formulate the policy, you know, slightly lower level that are in charge of the Korea policy, or in Campbell's case, you know, Asia policy in general, they're the ones who will really be formulating it. And then, you know, if it gets to negotiations, maybe, you know, that's where Sherman's, you know, experience can come in. But if the aim of the policy is, you know, sort of at odds with what diplomacy can be achieved, those people are not going to be, they're going to be useless. So, you know, it really depends on how, you know, Biden and Blinken decide to move. And obviously, you know, intelligence is going to play a big role in this too. So what Avril Haines does and, you know, it says it makes a big difference too. And I, by the way, I had this article about them in Responsible Statecraft recently about Levine, especially about Avril Haines. I always call her Avril Levine, Avril Haines. But like, you know, her past statements, recent statements are not hopeful on Korea.
So in closing, I promise to let you go after this.
Yeah.
With regards to the future of U.S. relations in the Far East, what do you think the worst possible outcome is? What is the crisis that could happen? And what are the better outcomes?
I think if they keep pushing this very hard line on North Korea and try to make it into this regional confrontation as opposed to U.S. versus North Korea, and with South Korean involvement, if they really push this hard line, there could easily be, you know, North Korea may do something like, you know, okay, end their moratorium on testing long-range missiles, and that would, you know, force the Bush, the Biden administration to do something. That's like the worst scenario would be, you know, a war, you know, getting to a military confrontation. But if they really listen to their ally in South Korea, they might learn something. If they took a more flexible position on sanctions, one of the issues of sanctions doesn't just have to do with North Korea. It has to do with South Korea and North Korea undertaking projects that they had agreed to do, you know, a few years ago when diplomacy was at a high level, right? They agreed all these different kinds of projects, including relinking their railroad, as a way to kind of build trust and build, you know, build trust and build towards a peace agreement. So railroads was key on their list. But the U.S. controlled U.N. command controls all movements across the border. So like when South Korea wanted to send, you know, a team on, you know, send their teams north to start working on this project, the U.S. blocked it, citing sanctions, right? It would violate sanctions. And South Korea has been trying to get the U.S. to be a little more flexible on the issue of sanctions that might affect cross-border projects just to get the peace process going. So, you know, I'm hoping that maybe, you know, Biden and his people will listen to Moon Jae-in about that and try not to push the confrontation as much as letting, you know, not see sanctions as be all end all. And, you know, maybe there could be, you know, I think the grounds are there for a decent agreement on Korea. And, you know, maybe it could involve South Korea and the United States do not have to have a military alliance and U.S. troops in South Korea forever. This is not written in stone. You know, that can change. This is something that's starting to be discussed very widely within South Korea itself. The next 70 years don't have to be like the past 70 years. You know, we can change. We can have our own relationship with China and not be under the thumb of the U.S. and demanding that, you know, we only proceed as they approve. So I'm hoping that, you know, South Korea itself can assert itself in a way that the U.S. can listen to what they want and try to resolve this in a way that protects the people of Korea, you know, from another war and lets Korea be Korea. The two sides should be able to, you know, move forward the way they choose. So that's my best hope, that they actually, you know, decide that, you know, confrontation is not gonna work. But my hopes are not terribly high.
Well, I think there's always hope for peace on the Korean Peninsula. And I think people like yourself and others have been fighting for that. And I appreciate that. I'd like to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views, Tim Sharrock. Your work over the years is very much appreciated. How can my listeners keep up with what you're doing and writing?
Well, probably the best way is if you follow me on Twitter, Timothy S. And I actually post a lot about Korea. And I also have a website, timsharrock.com. And then I have a lot of my old reporting on, you know, going way back. I've gotten, you know, hundreds and hundreds of documents declassified, and a lot of those are posted there. So, but Twitter is probably the best way.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Tim Sharrock, a guest that I have wanted to have on the show for quite some time. Finally able to do it, and I'm very proud of the conversation. Please be sure to check out his work at The Nation, and also follow him at Timothy S. on Twitter. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax, or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Rats, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15 doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.